Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Hello, and welcome once again to Sentient Developments, the podcast. My name is George Dvorsky, and I will be your host for the next half an hour or so. I've got several topics that I'd like to talk about tonight. First off, we're going to talk about the Toronto Transhumanist Association, which is a group I run here in Toronto, and we have monthly meetings. And I'm just going to quickly talk about our most recent event, which was a roundtable discussion about nanotechnology. So I'll get into, I'll talk a little bit about the TTA, and I'll talk about what we actually discussed, and talk about some molecular nanotechnology and some of the implications and some of the potentials for it. And after that, I'm going to go back to the Enlightenment, further to that theme. My last podcast, I talked about Condorcet. And today I'm going to discuss Denis Diderot, who is another seminal proto-transhumanist of the Enlightenment period. I'm also going to talk about Yahoo and Microsoft. Wow, how interesting is that? So I'll get my 2 cents in on that. And then finally, we'll talk about Martin Rees. And I'm going to, read a bit of a transcript of his from edge.org. And he and a whole bunch of other so-called intellectuals and scientists were asked the big question this year. And this year's question was, what have you changed your mind about? And Martin Rees answered that we should take the post-human era seriously. And I'll read some excerpts from his comment on there. So yeah, it looks like it was going to be an interesting show, and I'll see you after this track. So we have here in Toronto what I'd like to think is one of the more active transhumanist chapters anywhere in the world. And we're an official chapter of the World Transhumanist Association. And I co-founded it back with Simon Smith in and around 2002, 2003 or so. And we've had our on-again, off-again phases with the association. And we are currently in an on-again phase, I'd like to think. I'm pretty much Simon Smith has remained outside of the TTA's affairs. I've brought on some assistance in the name of Justin Trottier, who's a local organizer, humanist, and advocate for all things secular. And he's been a tremendous help to me. And what we've done this time around is we have tried to make it a bit more community-focused. And we have monthly meetings. That's the second Saturday of every month. And we have it at the Center for Free Inquiry at the Free Thought Center, which is near the University of Toronto campus. And it's a great little space. And through meetup.com and most significantly through Facebook, of all things. Well, I shouldn't say of all things, because Facebook has been a tremendous force for organizing, in my opinion, for networking. And I believe we're using it to its fullest potential here. And we've created the various transhumanist groups, both in Facebook and Meetup, and even through just general mailing lists and word of mouth, of course. And yeah, we've managed to get a good number of people coming out on a fairly regular basis. And what we've done is every second month will be either a roundtable discussion or it will be a speaker series. So, for example, a month ago we had Talman Firestone come in and talk about how we should enhance humans for space travel and for space exploration and space colonization. And it was an absolutely fascinating talk. Next month, I'm hoping, for example, to get somebody to come in and talk about cryonics. We'll see where that leads. I'll make an announcement once I've managed to actually book somebody. But this week, this month, February, we had a roundtable discussion about nanotechnology, and it was a fascinating discussion. And I tell you, for those of you who are transhumanists out there and who have gotten together on occasion with like-minded individuals and transhumanists, it can almost always make for an outstanding gathering. And lots of provocative conversation, lots of debates, and lots of heavy concept, and you learn a lot, and you have your mind blown on a fairly regular basis. And such was the case this time. And we had over one dozen people there today, which there was a time when I thought that would have been overly large group to show up for TTA meeting. Now that's about as small as it gets. We have had as many as 30 to 35 people come out for our events. And there's new faces all the time. So I'd like to think that basically across of the GTA area, we have anywhere from, I'd say maybe, 50 through to, to about 100 people who will come in and visit our group. And there's no cost. There's no formal membership, nothing like that. Just come on in and join some like-minded individuals for great conversation and some provocative talks. Where we take it in the future, only time will tell. Again, Justin and I, we're constantly thinking as to where we can take the TTA, what other kinds of things we can be doing other than monthly gatherings. And again, depending on the kind of participation we get and the kind of volunteer work that we're able to pull from the people that we have with us, perhaps maybe some more outreach, some more community work, some work putting out white papers or press releases, being more, let's say, of an activistic group to get the word out about human enhancement, about reproductive technologies, reproductive rights, and those sorts of issues, and perhaps start to exert a little bit of pressure on the political system, which is maybe that's outside of what the TTA should be doing, but maybe not. Maybe we should be embarking on those types of projects, or certainly we could create an offshoot to be more political. And along those lines, we are an official chapter of the World Transhumanist Association. And if you are in the GTA area, please contact me, George Dvorsky. You can reach me, george@betterhumans.com, and we can get you to come on out to our meetings. Or if you're in another city and you want to know, do you have a chapter or you want to start your own chapter, go ahead and contact the main parties at the World Transhumanist Association. I'm sure they'll help you out. And specifically, you want to contact James Clement, who's the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association. So what did we talk about? We talked about nano, and we addressed a number of issues, which I'll talk about now. We first described what the nanoscale was. I'm sure many of you know what the nanoscale is, but perhaps this little example will help perhaps bring some more perspective and illuminate just how small a scale we're talking about. But take a typical dime and look at the real, obviously the thin side of the dime, and divide that, I guess the depth of, or yeah, the width of the dime. What's the word I'm looking for? I guess it's the thin point of the dime. Divide that by 1,000 times, and take one of those slivers and divide that yet another 1,000 times, so 1/1000th, and you're now down to the nanometer. That is a very microscopic scale, very small. And when you're at that scale, you are now actually talking about moving molecules around, individual molecules and clumps of molecules. And the general idea here is that given our capacity to work at that scale, we can start to construct some pretty amazing things, whether it be simply materials, such as carbon nanotubes, or whether it be machines at that scale, little propellers and little levers and gears, the kinds of things that exist already in a state of nature. I mean, take a look at human biology. Our bodies are suffused with nanotechnology, albeit nanotechnology that has come about through natural selection and selectional pressures, of course. And in a way, whether it be mitochondria or how cells replicate or red blood cells, what have you, in a way, one could say that's proof of concept of nanotechnology. It's proof of concept that machines can exist at this scale. What it may not necessarily be proof of concept of is that we can actually create these things ourselves. And that's one of the things that we discussed during the meeting was, can we actually start to work at such a small scale, and what are some of the problems? And some of the things that we raised in the discussion were Richard Smalley's, for example, Richard Smalley, he's no longer with us, but he was a real opponent of Eric Drexler and put together what he called the sticky fingers argument, that we'd never be able to actually work at such a small scale due to those particular issues. And similarly, we also discussed, are there any quantum effects at this scale, or are there quantum effects that we are perhaps unaware of that are responsible for other emergent characteristics? And we talked, for example, about how there are some characteristics of DNA expression that would appear to be dictated by weirdness at the quantum level. Wow, if that's true, how do we even go about doing that? How do we work at such a small scale? And are there attendant issues then that come about when it comes to issues such as uploading and whole brain emulation? Interesting stuff. And like I said, anytime you get this kind of group together, you're always going to get some fascinating insights and some input. We talked about also the work that has been done and is being done by Robert Freitas. Robert Freitas is the, I'd say he's the medical nanotechnology expert. And he's put together some unbelievable projections and some unbelievable designs for some future, for future nanotechnology. He is the senior research fellow at the Institute for Molecular Manufacturing in California. And back in 1980, he was working with NASA, and he wrote a feasibility analysis of self-replicating space factories. Wow, talk about a guy ahead of his time. Although von Neumann quite obviously was talking about self-replicating entities and what are now called von Neumann probes back, I believe, in the 50s. He never would have had any kind of conception as to how they would have actually replicated, at least not anything accurate by today's standards, whereas Freitas back in the 1980s was now already talking about self-replication through kind of, I guess, at the nanoscale. He, meaning Robert Freitas, he also authored the first detailed technical design study of a hypothetical medical nanorobot ever published in a refereed medical journal. He was former research scientist at Zyvex Corp., and he is, most significantly, the author of Nanomedicine Volumes 1 and 2. And these are absolute tomes, but what they contain in them are page after page of mind-blowing concept. He designs nanorobots, at least theorizes as to what their designs will be like and what they could actually do, in particular in what he would call nanomedicine, so human application, health application. So there's three main examples that we talked about. There are what he calls respiracytes, which are red blood cells, oxygenating micromachines. And what these would do in the body is they would act as oxygenators. So if your heart were to stop, for example, the oxygenators would take over, and you could go to your doctor and get a new heart. The respiracyte, it would be an 18 billion atom structure, and it would have about 300 times the amount of oxygen that an organic red blood cell could carry. It could serve as a universal blood substitute. It could preserve living tissue. It would have some interesting implications for swimming, both in terms of being able to be underwater for prolonged periods, and you could even avoid the bends if you had your body filled with these things. It would, in all likelihood, allow for new sports records. You could probably run the 500-meter dash without even losing a breath. And perhaps more practically speaking, it would address such things as anemia, choking, lung diseases, asphyxia, and a number of other respiratory problems. So that's Robert Freitas and his respiracyte. Mind-blowing stuff. Other things that he speculated about are the development of T-cells or microbivores. These would destroy microbiological pathogens found in the human bloodstream, and it would use what he called a digest and discharge protocol. And of course, the biggie here is cellular repair machines, so little nanobots that are coursing through the body, fixing up those cells, whether it be replication problems, cancerous cells, senesced cells, all those sorts of issues. You have these little bots roaming around your body, dealing with it, fixing those cells. Fascinating stuff. So that's Robert Freitas. And so then in the discussion during the TTA meeting, we talked about, of course, risk and Grey Goo, global ecophagy. Again, Robert Freitas coining the term global ecophagy, and he was speculating about nanotechnology run amok. Could it destroy the atmosphere? And I believe both Freitas and Eric Drexler have scaled back some of their more apocalyptic projections of what nanotechnology could do. Although I do believe Freitas is still concerned about the potential for nano to destroy the atmosphere in particular. We talked a little bit about existential risk mitigation, and it was such an interesting thread that I decided to just kind of table that a little bit and propose that we have an entire roundtable discussion devoted to existential risks, both in terms of nanotechnology, gray goo, and whether it be a deliberately engineered pathogen, all those different sorts of existential risks that seem to be on the horizon now and will start to emerge with disturbing frequency. I guess also, so we'll talk about AI and singularities. That's going to be fascinating. So again, if you're in the GTA area and you want to come join a Toronto Transhumanist Association meeting, please come on down every second Saturday at the Free Thought Center. And again, in 2 months then, we're going to talk about existential risk and mitigation. How can we prevent apocalyptic destruction and the extinction of the human species? So yeah, it was a great meeting, always a fascinating discussion, always a great bunch of characters that come out. And like I said, I was so happy to see a lot of new faces. And look for, like I said, perhaps a discussion on nanotechnology. And our next talk will be, like I said, the second Saturday in March. Denis Diderot, very cool dude of the Enlightenment period. And again, the Enlightenment period being a time of intellectual renewal of the 18th century, leading up to and including the French Revolution. Scientific reinvigoration and definitely a period of renewed, or perhaps even depending on certain Western standards, the first time commitment to reason and rationality over religion and scripture. And as well, a time for discussing the potentials for human enhancement. And Denis Diderot was one of these individuals who I've described as being a proto-transhumanist. And again, last week I talked about Marquis de Condorcet. Diderot was a brilliant polymath. Wow, isn't it interesting how many polymaths are involved in either pre-transhumanist or full-blown transhumanist speculation? I wonder why that's the case. Well, perhaps it's obvious. Perhaps when you're a jack of all trades, when you know a little bit about everything, you sort of see a picture emerge, and you can take a step back and look at what is perhaps a big, let's say, a problem or an issue with the human condition, or a realization about the human condition, a sweeping overview of where we are as a species and where we could possibly be headed into the future. Maybe you need to be chemist, biologist, political scientist, historian, futurist, neuroscientist, philosopher, mathematician. musician, artist. I don't know. Maybe all these things. Maybe it all truly all helps to see a certain picture, and you have this transhumanist sentiment perhaps emerge. Well, Diderot was one such polymath. He would, amongst other things, was fascinated with the whole issue of free will, and was fascinated with the human mind and the brain and consciousness, and struggled over these sorts of issues. And with the renewed, renewed faith in science, or how about a conviction that science could actually work to help humans understand ourselves and our condition a bit better. Wondering what that could actually tell us about the human mind. So he, like many others, decided to analyze it through a more materialistic kind of frame. I'll get into this in just a second. He, again, seriously ahead of his time, he was talking about variation and natural selection a century before Darwin did the same. Now, I'm not suggesting that Diderot articulated natural selection in the same way that Darwin did, quite obviously not, but he was somewhat on the right track when he was discussing, what he was thinking of as variation and selection. He was big on analyzing human consciousness through the lens of human senses, and I'm somewhat partial to that. I do believe that our sensory capacities are very much a driver of human consciousness in terms of our width and breadth and scope of conscious experience. That the more sensory, the more profound and robust sensory experience we have, the greater conscious experience we have. And Diderot was somewhat on track with this also. He wrote a piece called, I forget what it was called now, but it was, He speculated again about the blind and what blind people have the potentials for, and he was quite convinced that you could use the other senses to make up for the lost senses. And again, he's right on track. And he speculated that the blind could be taught to read through the sense of touch. Interesting, because he was right. Obviously, Braille having been developed was proof of that. He speculated about the ultimate constitution of matter and the meaning of life. So he was looking for and trying to find the answers for the deep philosophical issues. And he was definitely very much in line with the secular movement of the time. And he contributed to Paul-Henri Thierry's Système de la Nature, the so-called Bible of Atheism at the time. And he also wrote, which I'm going to talk about now, D'Alembert's Dream in 1769. And by the way, Diderot lived from 1713 through to 1784. He wrote three related dialogues. This is the kind of format is that he didn't write like a formal essay. He wrote it like a dialogue between, like almost like a fictional dialogue between people talking amongst each other and philosophizing under certain contexts. And in D'Alembert's Dream, the conversation covered such topics as evolution, spontaneous generation being a concept we no longer accept as being any kind of credence. We've rejected that. Supreme intelligence. I wonder what Diderot was meaning about when he talked about supreme intelligence. Could it be artificial intelligence? Artificial super intelligence? Some kind of massively super intelligent entity that we would have created? I wonder. He also dabbled in psychology, and D'Alembert's Dream talked about psychology, and was also very much interested in reproduction and what we can do with reproduction and reproductive practices. He proposed a materialist view of the universe, and by that I mean nothing spiritual or divine or vitalistic. So the brain was a materialistic construction, something functional, something made out of the stuff of this world, and as such could be understood as something from this world. He speculated about polyp-type creatures or hybrids that would combine animal and plant characteristics, what today we would regard as being transgenic creatures, or in other circles referred to as chimeras. And he didn't think of these things as bad things. He wasn't like scared of these things or alarmist about these things. But how could we actually create these things, and what could we do that could be to our benefit? And he also discussed what could only be described as eugenics and crossbreeding. And again, he was speculating about mutations leading to changes in species a century before Darwin. and well before any conception of genetics and DNA. And again, the eugenics, the speculation there, or the thinking there was, again, about looking at different individuals and their characteristics and perhaps wanting to pass those characteristics on to the next generation, and even potentially prohibiting reproduction of others. Again, ideas that were, by today's standards, very politically incorrect, and rightfully so. But certainly, one cannot deny the influence, as the there was a certainly profound eugenics movement, and whether it be Nazi eugenics or even the more liberal eugenics, maybe that's not even fair to refer to as liberal eugenics, but the kinds of eugenic practices that were put in place in and around the midpoint of the 20th century. He saw homosexuality and masturbation as a part of the natural order and something that was virtually harmless. And again, by today's standards, it's like, well, so what? But back then, that would have been pretty controversial stuff, with the church having as a prominent role in social mores that you couldn't really discuss these sorts of things. And as a materialist, he also put forth what he called the blank slate theory of mind. And again, the idea here was that you're born with a blank slate, and it is fed throughout your whole life by your sensory experiences and what you pull into your brain through your experiences in the world. He considered the brain to be a machine, and as such, speculated that machine minds would eventually be possible. But not only that, minds could be deconstructed and rebuilt at a later time, and we could preserve identity. And science, he thought, if allowed to develop, could eventually bring the dead back to life. Wow. Serious thinker in the 18th century, and we're still coming to grips with these ideas, still coming to grips with these ideas to think of will they actually come to be? And these are still scientifically and philosophically challenging questions and technical, with lots of technical hurdles to overcome. But there you go. People were talking about this back in the 18th century, and Denis Diderot being one of them. So, yeah, Denis Diderot, brilliant polymath, proto-transhumanist of the Enlightenment period, and obviously very much and deeply influential to a number of the transhumanist and like-minded individuals who emerged in the following centuries. Microsoft wants to buy Yahoo for nearly $45 billion. Huge news making the rounds the last couple of weeks. And what's perhaps even more significant, aside from what this reveals about Microsoft and their failing strategy, is the news that Yahoo has turned them down, saying that they've been grossly undervalued, which kind of makes you wonder just how much they think they're worth, if not $45 billion. Wow. It's shocking, but at the same time, not entirely surprising that Microsoft would actually pursue this course of action. It's not surprising because, and we've sort of seen the writing on the wall for quite some time with software. I remember back in the 90s, and even as few as about 5 or 6 years ago, thinking that I've had it with software, and that wouldn't it be nice when finally we can do away with software and work exclusively on web-based apps. So I guess it's somewhat of a misnomer to say that there wouldn't be any more software. Of course, there's always going to be software. But what What has changed, and what Microsoft now has realized is the nature of software has changed in terms of licensing, in terms of accessibility, in terms of how you access the software applications. And Google has been right on top of these things right from the get-go. And for those of you who are familiar with Google Apps, you'll know what I'm talking about, and some of their other services, whether it be Google AdWords or, of course, through their Gmail account and all the integration that happens therein. Microsoft is falling way behind, and they risk becoming somewhat anachronistic. Their model risks becoming obsolete. And I can speak from experience here. At Commune Media, which is my company, we have thus far stayed away from any licensing issues, and we've never had to, aside from maybe the odd special app, we haven't had to use any productivity programs that require us to purchase something and load it on each local machine, get a license, and so on. What we've done is we've moved to the CRM model such that everything is web-based. We initially went with some 37 Signals solutions, but we've since migrated to Salesforce, and some of you may be familiar with that. And again, everything is web-based. You log into your account from wherever you are in the world, so long as you have internet access, and you have your entire company at your fingertips, including all of the various productivity apps required for, let's say, project management, resource allocation, contacts database, all those sorts of goodies. You can even set up things like broadcast emails and newsletters, that sort of thing. And for productivity, specifically like making word processor documents or spreadsheets or PowerPoint, we've been using Google Apps, and it's been adequate. I won't say it's absolutely fantastic, but it's been adequate, and it's met our needs. The only times that we've had to resort to actually working in a Microsoft platform or Microsoft product is when our clients require that bit of compatibility. In other words, we get, let's say, a Word document back and the formatting has to be just right. We've been, in a way, forced to use the old Microsoft suite of applications. So that's been somewhat frustrating and limiting in that sense. But eventually, I think things are going to change such that both Google Apps will probably get up there in terms of its quality, in terms of its ability to match some of the other programs out there. And of course, as other people, let's say, migrate to different and more standardized web-based applications. So where does this leave us right now? Where does this leave Yahoo and Microsoft? Yahoo, I guess, and they certainly must feel this way, that they're still very much neck and neck with Google in terms of getting that market share. And I think that's all cool and all well. I think Google could use the competition and could use that sort of threat on their business. That it does spur innovation. It'll keep them on their toes, and we can continue to expect to see greatness from both Google and Yahoo. And what does that mean for Microsoft? What do they do next? They have to reinvent themselves, I think. They have to look at everything that they're doing, reevaluate it, and forget the model where you've got that box on a store shelf and you've got to load it on your local machine. That's history. That's done. And it's becoming more and more done with each passing moment and with each passing web-based application, like whether 37 Signals, Salesforce, Google Apps, or the literally hundreds, if not thousands, of other web-based applications out there. Do I like to see Microsoft suffer like this? Not really. I don't like to see any company do poorly, but of course Microsoft has been the bane of much frustration and angst ever since the days of Windows 95, if not even before then. But interesting news. Very interesting news as Yahoo turns down Microsoft's offer to buy them out for $45 billion. We'll be right back. Martin Rees, or rather Sir Martin Rees, the very well-respected physicist. He's actually the president of the Royal Society, professor of cosmology and astrophysics, master at Trinity College at the University of Cambridge, the author of Our Final Hour, which was also, it was known as Our Final Century in Europe, The 50-50 Threat to Humanity's Survival, which was actually a very, very good and very accessible look into existential risks. Sir Martin Rees was asked by Edge.org, along with many, many other intellectuals, to answer the big question of the year, which was, what have you changed your mind about? Well, Sir Martin Rees, who really has been in tune with the transhumanist potential for quite some time now, answered that we should take the post-human era seriously. Martin Rees has always talked about, well, not always, but in recent memory anyways, has talked about the possibility for machine minds and post-biological intelligences, and has speculated about, of course, existential risk stemming from such things as artificial intelligence and nanotechnology. So he's right there amongst many of the other futurists who project the same kind of a future, what we would refer to, I guess, as transhumanist-bent futurists. What I'd like to do is read an excerpt from Rees's article for the Edge.org. It's really, really interesting, really good. And I hope you don't mind my reading, but I'm going to do my best to make it sound like I'm not so much reading. So here are the words from Sir Martin Rees answering the question, what have you changed your mind about? And his answer being, we should take the post-human era seriously. Human-induced changes are occurring with runaway speed. It's hard to predict a mere century from now because what will happen depends on us. This is the first century where humans can collectively transform or even ravage the entire biosphere. Humanity will soon itself be malleable to an extent that's qualitatively new in the history of our species. New drugs and perhaps even implants into our brains could change human character. The cyber world has potential that is both exhilarating and frightening. We can't confidently guess lifestyles, attitudes, social structures, or population sizes a century hence. Indeed, it's not even clear for how long our descendants would remain distinctively human. Darwin himself noted that not one living species will transmit its unaltered likeness to a distant futurity. Our own species will surely change and diversify faster than any predecessor via human-induced modifications, whether intelligently controlled or unintended, not by natural selection alone. Just how fast this could happen is disputed by experts, but the post-human era may only be centuries away. These thoughts might seem irrelevant to practical discussions, and best left to speculative academics and cosmologists. I used to think this, but humans are now individually and collectively so greatly empowered by rapidly changing technology that we can, by design, or as unintended consequences, engender global changes that resonate for centuries. And sometimes, at least, policymakers indeed think far ahead. The global warming induced by fossil fuels burnt in the next 50 years could trigger gradual sea level rises that continue for a millennium or more. And in assessing sites for radioactive waste disposal, governments impose the requirements that they be secure for 10,000 years. It's real political progress that these long-term challenges are higher on the international agenda, and that these planners seriously worry about what might happen more than a century hence. But in such planning, we need to be mindful that it may not be people like us who confront the consequences of our actions today. We are custodians of a post-human future, here on Earth and perhaps beyond, that can't just be left to writers of science fiction. Those again are the words of Sir Martin Rees answering the Edge.org question, what have you changed your mind about? Rees, obviously, perhaps a bit conservative in terms of his timelines. He was saying that we could expect to see a post-human potential in a few centuries hence. Obviously, that's a bit longer than some of the other projections that we're more familiar with, whether it be from Hans Moravec or Ray Kurzweil, who do project something around the midpoint of the 21st century. And maybe he's being safe, and perhaps being safe in a way that's that could actually play itself out, that there are always wild cards and other factors that may delay the onset of the kind of future that we've envisioned. But certainly the kinds of data that Ray Kurzweil has put forward would indicate that something rather disruptive will happen in about 50, 60 years hence, if not sooner. So there you have it. Sir Martin Rees, we should take the post-human era seriously. And that ends... Yeah, that ends my podcast for today. Thank you very much for joining me. As requested by some of my listeners, I'm going to let you know what tracks we listened to today. The first track was from Porcupine Tree, from their excellent album Fear of a Blank Planet from last year. The song was... Oh, sorry, that wasn't from Fear of a Blank Planet. That was from their EP, Nil Recurring. And this, the song was called What Happens Now. Second track I played was Nine Inch Nails' Vessel. And for those of you who are familiar with the Nine Inch Nails album from last year entitled Year Zero, they might not have recognized it. And that's because it's the remix done by Bill Laswell of Vessel. Third track was Radiohead's House of Cards from their Rainbows CD. And the last track we heard there was from Riverside. Riverside, a Polish prog rock band. And from their album Rapid Eye Movement, the track was called Beyond the Eyelids. So there you have it, folks. Those were the tracks that we played. I'll make that a regular routine now during my podcast to list the tracks at the end. Glad you're enjoying the music. That's fabulous. It's some of my favorite stuff that I put in there. Try to create a bit of a mood and try to highlight some of the stuff that I've been listening to lately. Once again, thank you so much for listening to my podcast today. Look for my next one in about a week's time. And until then, take care and bye-bye.